Welcome to another exciting episode of Inside UMiami Medicine. I'm your host, Henry Ford, the Dean and Chief Academic Officer of the University of Miami Leonard M. Miller School of Medicine. Today, I am truly honored to welcome a true luminary scientist, an expert in the field of drug discovery, Dr. Raymond Shinazi. Dr. Shinazi is not only a preeminent scientist, but also a successful entrepreneur, a great philanthropist, and a world leader in nucleoside chemistry and biology. He not only developed the cure for hepatitis C, but also an estimated 94% of patients being treated worldwide for HIV are receiving a drug that he invented. He has founded several biotech companies focused on antiviral drug discovery, and his work has saved millions of lives. Dr. Shinazi continues to work actively as a leading scientist based at Emory University and as a voluntary faculty right here at the Miller School of Medicine. I'm also excited to welcome to the studio for one more time Dr. Mario Stevenson, who previously joined us on Inside UMiami Medicine last year. Dr. Stevenson is an internationally recognized molecular virologist, and he holds the inaugural Raymond F. Shinazi and Family Endowed Chair in Biomedicine. So thank you both for joining me today, and I'm truly excited about what we're going to talk about. But before we do, Dr. Shinazi, you've had a fascinating and enviable journey in the world of scientific discovery. Tell us a little bit about your journey of growing up in Egypt and then now becoming this preeminent scientist.
First of all, thank you very much for inviting me. It's a real honor to be among you today. And I love coming to Miami, such a beautiful city. Actually, I have a long history with Miami. My grandfather actually lived in Miami for many years. So, and he's actually buried here. So it's always a great place to visit and spend time with good friends. But we came from a long way. Both my grandfather and myself, we both came out of Egypt, as we say. We came out of Egypt under bad circumstances during the time of Nasser. And we came out, in my case, I came out as an immigrant, a 13-year-old immigrant. Ended up in Naples as a refugee, and then found my way to study in England with a scholarship at the boarding school. And after the boarding school, went to Bath University. And my dream was to come to the U.S. So my uncle was already in the U.S. My family has been in the U.S. since 1948. So it made sense to us coming out of Egypt to become Americans and to live in this country. And started off at Yale University, spent 2.5 years. It got really cold there, as you can imagine. And I decided that I need to be in the South. So I didn't come all the way to Miami. Maybe I should have. But I ended up in Atlanta, Georgia, at Emory University. And I've been there for about 46 years.
Well, so how would you say your experiences are having to leave Egypt and then and make up where you are right now. How did those influence your journey into science? And was this good? Was this bad? And tell us about that.
So it was traumatic for my family, I must say. But for me, it was like an adventure. And I remember vividly when my mother, a few years before we left Egypt, developed an infection, a yeast infection. And we had to treat her with medicine, a simple antifungal agent. But unfortunately, because Egypt is considered a third world country, we didn't have the medicine. And fortunately, my grandfather had a connection with a TWA pilot, and we were able to bring in the drug from the United States. And lo and behold, they gave the drug, and a few days later, my mother was basically on her deathbed, survived, and lived on to be 94 years old. So it's quite remarkable. That had left a big impression on me, that the simple pills can actually cure people from a fungal infection. Of course, had my uncle here in the United States already established here working as a herpes virologist, so I wanted to follow his footsteps and do something useful with my life, and I thought that virology would be a good area, but I didn't know much about virology. And today, virology is mostly molecular biology, cell culture, animal models, all this stuff comes together. And at the time, I thought it would be a good idea to become a chemist so I could develop drugs. And once I developed drugs, I could now help humanity. So then I went on to study chemistry, of all things. And I was good at chemistry, and that's why I chose chemistry. And that led me to learn biology on the way to learning chemistry. And then from there, the rest is history.
That's fantastic. So you had this aha moment, this epiphany, through that infection that your mom had, and then seeing what the drug did, essentially set you on course to become this brilliant scientist.
And the drug was something that every lab in the United States has today. They use it for cell culture to maintain cells. And it's the trade name is micostatine, but it's fungizole. So everybody knows fungizole, who was in the business. A simple molecule, but there wasn't a single pill available in the whole of Egypt. And that's a real world problem, bringing these medicines to the third world. And certainly we'll continue to do this, as you'll hear more later on about my experience with Egypt and giving back to Egypt as well.
So I'm getting up to the virology piece, but what made you decide to go to Yale for your postdoc?
Actually, I was given, you know, life is about choices. So I had a few choices. Wisconsin University offered me a position. The Weizmann Institute offered me a position.
Very prestigious.
And then I had also a position at Yale. And I was taken because my mentor, his name is William Prusoff. He is actually the grandfather of antivirals. And I wanted to learn virology rather than doing cancer research. I was thinking about doing cancer. I was actually a cancer researcher. My PhD studies in England at Bath University was based on chemistry of an anti-cancer drug called eliptocene, which is a natural product from plants from Fiji. And it's very, very good DNA intercalator, basically a compound that binds the DNA and has a strong affinity for DNA and basically stops the cancer from growing. But I thought that's not going to help me become a virologist. So I wanted to learn about virology based on my uncle's experience. He was a herpes virologist. He was a medical doctor. And I thought it would be a great thing to learn with Bill Prusoff, who was basically the grandfather of antivirals. And Yale was not a bad place to be. So I said, wow. I spent 2.5 years there, a floor with over 100 postdocs on one floor. We had the greatest people in pharmacology. We had Paul Greengard, Nobel laureate, for example, on the same floor as I was. We had all these young people studying, working almost 24 hours a day, 18 hours a day. Nobody was shy of working. It was an amazing environment.
So this... And before, again, we go to virology. Now, here you are in this impressive environment. And since our audience also has a number of PhD students and people who are studying early in their career, so tell us, what made you decide to go into academia as opposed to going to industry?
To be honest, I tried to get to academia. And in Europe, when I was still living in Europe, I thought about going to industry. And I applied for a few jobs. And frankly, they were not terribly interesting to me. So I thought to myself, I just need to continue and see if I have more choices as I get. I already had my PhD, but the question is, what do I do with that PhD? I could have gone to industry. I actually applied, for example, I applied at the time to Merck for a job. And they told me, we don't do antivirals. We're not interested in antivirals. We're not at the time. They were interested in vaccines. And I was not a vaccinologist. So I was a bit frustrated. So I said, okay, let's keep studying and maybe something will come up. And eventually I like the free academic freedom. I'm a free thinker and I wanted to do what I wanted to do. But the key is to have good mentors. And I was very fortunate in my life to have amazing mentors, including my uncle, who, as I told you, was a famous herpes virologist.
Okay, so now you go to Emory. After Yale, you're working with your uncle and a herpes virologist, and this is about the time that HIV becomes known.
Correct.
And so what made you decide to start focusing on that? What triggered the pivot?
The bottom line is that HIV came along. We didn't know it was going to be a virus. It turned out to be a virus. It could have been a fungi. It could have been a bacteria. It turned out to be a virus. And I was exceptionally well prepared for that because we know that the first drugs against any virus is usually a nucleoside. At the time, acyclovir was just approved for herpes simplex virus infection. And in fact, my uncle was involved in the first study on acyclovir and with Larry Corey and others. And and I was involved in that study as well. So as a PhD, I had shifted from chemistry to virology, pure virology and animal virology. And HIV came along and we knew it was a virus. I happened to have, believe it or not, I even had AZT in my lab. So I set up the first lab at Emory University, the first HIV lab, which was not easy in those days. They weren't very favorable to me to start working on HIV. Everybody was afraid of HIV. At the time, we didn't even know if HIV was a respiratory virus or something else. So we got the virus from the
food. Not afraid.
I was not afraid. Of course, my wife at the time was afraid. Everybody else was afraid to be near me. It's a bit like the crisis that happened with COVID, but believe it or not, it wasn't. We know well now that HIV is not transmitted the way that flu is transmitted. Thankfully, but we wouldn't be here today. It's an important point to make. I think there would be no, we wouldn't be communicating anymore. We will be all doing by. If there was Zoom in those days, we would have been using Zoom and not having this type of face-to-face conversation. So HIV, really, we had to do something. We couldn't just sit around doing nothing. It was an opportunity for me. I had some funding in herpes virus combination chemotherapy from herpes viruses, but the key was how do we develop drug quickly for people who are dying. And people were dying, literally dying at that time, begging for drugs. There was nothing available. AZT came along, it sort of was a Band-Aid. And then other drugs we were involved. I got involved with my old mentor at Yale, Prusoff. We discovered D4T, stavidine, very successful drug at the time, probably one of the second generation compound, but still not optimal. And after that, in the early 90s, we discovered probably two of the most important drugs today, which are still being used, emtricitabine and lamivudine.
Being some great point to interject. Tell us a little bit about how your background in nucleoside biology and nucleoside analogs came to be so important.
Yeah. Well, nucleoside analogs are small molecules. Most of them are already bioavailable. They don't have protein binding. And we know where the target is. The target is the polymerase of the virus, if you can get a selective one. The polymerase is an important enzyme for the replication of HIV. So if you can block that, you can block the virus replicating. And we know that if we block that, the virus, the disease will stop. Simple as that. So we develop drugs that fool the cells to take up these unnatural nucleosides and cause what we know as today as chain termination. So there's no more elongation of the DNA. And when you have that happening, you can stop the virus replication in its track.
You had a distinct advantage over the...
Yeah, we had those answers. We didn't have to go randomly searching for a target. We knew the targets. We had the experience with acyclovir and other drugs that came before what we know today as AZT, D4T, and all these other compounds. But the key was the toxicity. So we wanted to have drugs not only are effective against the virus, but are extremely safe. And we finally found compounds, and I can talk more about these compounds because I think they are excellent compounds that have saved millions of lives.
I mean, you make it sound easy, the way you describe the discovery process. But if you look at, you know, what you've developed, I think more than 20 FDA-approved drugs, that's more successful than most pharmaceutical companies. So what is it that made you so productive and successful over and above what can be achieved in a pharmaceutical company?
You're absolutely right. The special sauce is actually taking risk. And drug companies, as you know, they're very conservative. They have committees making decisions, not individuals. That's one of the advantages of being in academia. You can make a decision and you can go ahead and prove whether your hypothesis is correct. You make the molecule and test it and see if it works. In industry, they will think 15 times, 20 times about starting a project, first of all. And secondly, they at the time, even most labs didn't have a BL2 facility for testing drugs. We had that available. We set up the lab ourselves. Third, they look at the computers and all this stuff and make decisions. And it has to go all the way up and down to decide whether we're going to start on the project with HIV or not. What is our priority? We went ahead, and in fact, they will find maybe 20 reasons not to start a project or not to do something. In academia, you can make the decision fairly quickly. And that's the advantage of being, have the academic freedom, what we call academic freedom, which is very important to me, at least. And that's one of the reasons why I've stayed so long in academia. We can make our own decisions. And I had an idea. And I actually went to England to see my mentor, my PhD mentor, showed him the structure I wanted to make on the compound I want to make. He said, that's impossible to make. We tried it and it worked. And that was the beginning of probably the most exciting area of nucleoside chemistry ever, because the field of nucleoside chemistry was very well worked out by a lot of people, a lot of giants before me. But nobody had thought of making what we call today L-nucleosides, which are mirror images of the normal nucleosides. Normal nucleosides are all what we call D-nucleosides. And the ones we were making were L-nucleosides. They're basically the left hand instead of the right hand. They have mirror images. So we made these L-nucleosides. We didn't know which one was going to be the best compound. It turned out the L was more potent and more, especially less toxic. And that was the key. The lesson is also something I've realized is you have to have innovative chemistry. Nobody on the planet had ever made these compounds previously. Nobody ever expected these compounds to be made to be active against viruses. So we opened up the field of L-nucleosides. It was a breakthrough, a huge breakthrough.
We said at the beginning that 94% of patients receiving some form of treatment for HIV are receiving one of your drugs. Tell me a little bit more about that.
But the
contamination, yeah.
94%?
Well,
94%, why 94%? Somebody calculated that. It's actually probably 98%. I'm not going to take credit for
it. I'm sorry.
I'm not going to take credit of 94, but 94 is the official number put out by Emory. It doesn't really matter, the number. I think saving lives is what matters. And we've had a tremendous impact. I think probably the biggest impact has been on maternal fetal transmission. We basically eliminate that thanks to the drugs we created. We've eliminated the transmission among homosexual and heterosexual people who are having sex, unprotected sex, using, I'm not saying you should not use condoms, but certainly this has been a tremendous benefit to patients. And that's what keeps me sleep. I sleep very, very well because of what I've done. I'm very happy to have done what we did. We saved a lot of people's lives and continue to save lives.
Dr. Shinazi, you have had a tremendous impact on human life, especially in the area of HIV. But as Dr. Stevenson and I have discussed in our podcast, the cure, a permanent cure for the disease, is still not there. Why is the permanent cure for HIV so elusive? And what is on the frontier for us? And both of you, feel free to combine and.
Well, I think the issue has been people have tried to find a vaccine. The virus has been able to evade every type of attack on it because it is a lentivirus. It's a virus that mutates significantly, very, very significantly. It's a amazing versatility. This virus adapts itself very well to humans, unfortunately. And people have tried, and I don't think they've tried their best. I think there are opportunities still out there for a cure for HIV. It depends how you define cure, but certainly a functional cure is possible. And I think we're reaching towards that. Already, in a way, we have a functional cure in quotes. The drugs that we invented, for example, taking PrEP prevents the virus from transmission. That's already, if you can keep going on that for forever, for a long time, one generation, then you actually have a cure. You cure everybody who has HIV. Eventually, you cure them from the point of view you can't transmit the virus. If you can't transmit the virus, you basically solve a problem. But that's not very practical because people have to take the pills every day. So I think immunology is having a tremendous impact in modern immunology that's happening with the antibodies, the newer antibodies that we have that are extremely efficient. You can still get resistance to them. But if you are able to combine a couple of them together, the right ones, it's going to be a lot harder for the virus. The question is, do you inject the antibodies, or there are ways to provide the antibodies with just one single injection, for example? And don't want to go into much detail, but I think the future is there to make a difference. And I think the University of Miami, with some of my friends at University of Miami, are doing some amazing things. I'm not directly involved with them, but it's got to be, I think it has great potential.
And I think you explained to us before during the last podcast that the virus is dormant in the cell, but you have to wake it up, hit it with the antibody. But the problem is that the body develops an antibody against the antibody. But you are finding ways to evade that problem. Remind us.
Yes. So, the antibodies, as Ray commented, are remarkable, but they're very unusual. The reason they're so potent and they work against all of the HIV strains out there is because they have a very unusual structure. And that's what makes them visible to the immune system. The immune system thinks they're foreign proteins rather than human proteins and makes antibodies against them, called the anti-drug antibody response. So to realize the power of this discovery, these broadly neutralizing antibodies, someone has to figure out how to stop the antibodies being rejected by the immune system. And that's a very active area of investigation here and elsewhere. Whoever solves that problem, I think, is going to deliver cure, vaccine for HIV. And actually we have a symposium, a Center for AIDS Research symposium this Friday. Ray will be there. We have some amazing speakers. We'll talk about some of the efforts. For example, we have a representative of the Gates Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has invested significant amounts of money, hundreds of millions, to develop a genetic cure for HIV. And Mike McCune, who is known to both of us, is going to talk about what's called the Grand Challenge Project to Bill the Gates, to develop a genetic therapy for HIV that cures HIV by 2036 or thereabouts. I'm not a big fan of genetic therapies. I think great technology, but not the right disease. But again, I'm open to being convinced otherwise.
And I'd like to add that I think the technology that the UM group is developing could have application well beyond HIV. So every technology, it's like we discovered the value of drug like lamivudine for HIV. But now people are thinking that these drugs could also be useful for people who have embedded in them old viruses, what we call retroprosal and things like that, that are embedded, and you can now prevent the reactivation, actually have an impact on Alzheimer's, for example. So there's other dividends you get from these major discoveries. So we're looking forward to seeing more of these as time goes on.
Not worried that this line of research that our group here at UM is undertaking is going to make some of the drugs that you have brought forward obsolete?
So the way I look at it is that I've established a legacy, but there's another opportunity to establish a second legacy. So that's the way I look at it. It doesn't matter to me. I think the important thing is to get this done. Hopefully they're not there, but we have backup systems in case things can fail, of course. But we're not aiming to fail, but we've got to try our best to make it work.
Well, I think this is a fantastic place to pause on the fact, recognizing the fact that your work has been so transformative and has impacted so many lives, and there is hope on the horizon for a permanent cure. And hopefully it's going to happen right here with the two of you participating in those novel findings. That's a promise. Or is that a wish?
No, we I think there's a good chance we're going to make it work.
Fantastic. So, this has been our episode of Inside Umami Medicine podcast. I'm Henry Forward, joined today by Dr. Mary Stevenson and Dr. Reshnaz. Please stay tuned for the second part of this fascinating discussion.